This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we air a forum on climate change's effect on minority communities in the state, the nation, and across the world. Almost 2 years ago, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, released a landmark report that called for the limiting of average temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius, beyond which even marginal increases to global temperatures would mean significantly worse and more frequent risk of drought, floods, extreme heat, and poverty for hundreds of millions of people. With average temperatures already 1 degree hotter than pre-industrial levels, the recommended parameters for avoiding a higher than 1.5 degree change are a 45% cut in global carbon pollution by 2030. A number of unfolding natural disasters provide examples that support the report's dire predictions. This year, California's unprecedented series of wildfires have burned 1.4 million acres, displaced over 100,000 Californians, and killed at least 7 people. The fires have been triggered by lightning strikes during a record-breaking heat wave caused by an increasingly hot and dry climate. At the same time, the U.S. Gulf Coast prepares for the landfall of Hurricane Laura as a potential Category 3 storm. By tracking data since 1979, researchers have found that climate change is driving tropical storms to rise to Category 3 or higher. The destruction caused by these storms will have disastrous effects for coastal communities and especially those without the resources to weather them. Speaking on today's panel is Daniel Mendoza, Research Assistant Professor in Atmospheric Sciences and Pulmonary Fellow at the School of Medicine at the University of Utah, Olivia Juarez, Latinx Community Organizer for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, Rebecca Chavez-Hauck, former Democratic member of the Utah State House of Representatives, and Sarah Grineski, Professor of Sociology and Environmental and Sustainability Studies at the University of Utah. Moderating the discussion is Jenny Wen, Sustainability Ambassador for the University of Utah's Sustainability Office. This forum was recorded on September 25th, 2019.
Hello, and thank you for the invitation to participate here. We're actually just chatting about how most of us work on the second, third floors, and we always see this nice glass wall. So we're thinking, what's going on in here? So now we're insiders. Really what has motivated me in terms of looking at social equity, social justice, or environmental justice, what has motivated me is I ride my bike around here. That's sort of my form of exercise. And oftentimes, so I live really close to campus. Oftentimes, we go up on the Legacy Parkway towards Farmington, for example. I do basically an east-west cross-section of Salt Lake City. So I ride out, go by the avenues, go by Rose Park, and then end up going north. And what I've often found is that there's a large discrepancy in many issues, so not necessarily just structural, for example, the houses and the condition of the houses, but also behavioral. And one of the things that I find what I found from the very beginning that was very, very shocking was, especially during the summer when I would ride my bike and some people were mowing their lawn, for example, families were mowing their lawns, and unfortunately they had their small child basically right next to where the exhaust was going out from the lawnmower. Those kind of behavioral things, very small things that people can do to alter the air quality that they face. I think one of the main problems, and this, I'm allowed to say climate change here, right? Okay. one of the main concerns with climate change and really tackling our air quality is having this sense of despair, or rather the sense of hope. Too many times we see people thinking, oh, air quality is such a huge problem, I can do nothing. But the reality is, depending on what your behavior is, depending on how close you are to other sources, for example, you can be responsible for between 30 to 80% of your local, meaning yours and your neighbor's air quality. If you choose to idle your car in your driveway for 20 to 30 minutes while you check all your emails, your texts, and reply to Facebook messages, you're endangering not just yourself, because your house is taking in some air. Your neighbors are taking in some air to their houses, or their kids are playing out on the street. If you're choosing to, as I said, if you can take your kids inside, make sure that they're not exposed to the exhaust from your lawnmower, or better yet, if there are plans to, for example, exchange lawnmowers or lawn equipment or anything to electric, then you're doing your community a favor. If you're looking at, for example, putting window plastic around your windows, so then that way you reduce your energy footprint, exchange some light bulbs for LEDs. These small changes, we're not saying go out and, you know, outfit your entire house with solar panels. That's available to a small fraction of the population, or get an electric car. Those are huge investments, and maybe not everyone can do that, but in partnership, for example, with Utah Clean Energy, we've worked towards exchanging LED light bulbs with communities. And what we did, what was interesting, was we didn't just give away the LEDs, we actually asked for community members to bring their light bulbs, which meant that they had to put the LEDs in. So small changes can do a lot and give us some hope. And when you start to see, for example, your electric bill has reduced by even a little bit for us, for a community that may be socioeconomically challenged, those $20, $30 could mean a couple more meals, could actually mean a small trip that the family can take and enjoy their lives. So that's really my focus on trying to make sure that it's equitable and that it's accessible to everyone. And I guess I forgot to say my name. I'm Daniel Mendoza. And as mentioned, I'm a research assistant professor in atmospheric sciences here at the U, and I'm also a pulmonary fellow at the School of Medicine.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for sharing your lunchtime with us here at the Hinckley. My name is Olivia. I'm University of Utah alum, class of 2017 in the College of Humanities, and I am the Latinx community organizer at the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. I'm one of six community organizers spread all around the nation working towards the shared mission of protecting our outstanding wildlands at the heart of the Colorado Plateau for the benefit of all. I also wear a couple of other hats. I am one of 10 advisory board members on Uplift Climate. It is a young people's climate justice movement, which convenes a young people's and elders climate justice conference somewhere different on the Colorado Plateau every year. The recent one just occurred in Gallup, New Mexico. Basically to uplift frontline communities. These are the communities usually of color or poor communities that are disproportionately impacted by climate justice and oftentimes have been impacted by climate change injustice issues for several generations now. Finally, I am on the board of Utah Coalition of La Raza, where we're starting to assess what Maine environmental justice needs can be applied to promote Chicano, Latinx, and community of color health throughout the state of Utah, specifically here in along the Wasatch Front. The majority of everything that I'm doing, though, is situated in making sure that we have a clean, healthy environment, and a lot of that comes from our public lands. There are around 9.5 million acres of public land administrated by the Bureau of Land Management throughout the state of Utah that look exactly like they belong in Canyonlands or Arches National Park, but don't have the protective conservation designation that our parks have. So I'm talking about areas like the San Rafael Swell, Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and public lands surrounding places like Hovenweep, Canyons of the Ancients, and Bears Ears National Monument in San Juan County. Four times a year, the Bureau of Land Management will put these public lands on auction at the request of oil and gas companies to lease for oil and gas extraction. Regardless of what resources, for really lack of a better word, every body and every thing in these public lands are at stake when there's the threat of an oil well or a natural gas fracking pad. Especially in San Juan County, it is rife with the cultural resources, the sacred sites of indigenous peoples all throughout the Southwest and the world. Incredible biodiversity, clean air, clean water that is sold off to oil and gas companies in a very limiting process, which does not involve a really meaningful opportunity for the public, all of you, to speak out for everything that's threatened by this oil and gas extraction. So my job as a community organizer, specifically organizing Latino, Latina, Latinx communities and communities of color toward this is towards the end of leasing our public lands in Utah for oil and gas extraction. Specifically, as far as SUA is concerned, the ones that are wild, the last remaining places that haven't changed due to post-colonial contact from settler colonialism and capitalism. It's also toward the end of recognizing that conservation advocacy and advocacy period is something that should be accessible to people of all different cultures and backgrounds, and putting the resources towards that. So my job as an organizer is what you might have in your mind of a community organizer for anybody generally. It's being out in the community, building relationships, and providing whatever tools and resources I can, or creating the tools and resources that might need to be available to uplift the voices of youth, single moms, working parents, and people without, sometimes even a high school education, and let them know that public lands are for them too. I want to also recognize that the public lands that we're working to protect, and really all land which we are on, is stolen land by a lot of different communities of people. So from right here at the University of Utah, where we stand, live, work, play, and come to school on Ute and Shoshone lands, and throughout southern Utah and the rest of the state, the lands of Paiute, Diné, different Ute tribes, Hopi, and several Pueblos, and so much more that I couldn't even really begin to, like, it's a big list. that these lands also deserve the opportunity for those whose these lands are ancestral to them, indigenous people, to have a voice in this management. So a huge part of what SUA has been working on for the past couple of years is the protection of Bears Ears, which brought five tribes to have that say in land management, using traditional knowledges and ancestral wisdom that is held in these peoples in order to protect our land, especially in times of a changing climate. Grand County, where Moab is, and San Juan County are out of attainment, air quality attainment for ozone. It's rural communities and these communities of color that have to deal with the impact of any kind of fossil fuel extraction when it comes to the water that is polluted, the air that is polluted, and also the violence that comes to these communities. So I also would want to give a shout out to everybody campaigning for the missing and murdered Indigenous women, because public land extraction and extraction in rural places, period, is what is leading to a lot of the violence against Indigenous bodies in our own region and throughout the country.
Good afternoon, everyone. Again, thank you for joining us today, and thanks for joining the group here to talk about this issue, these issues. Again, my background is that I recently served in the Utah State Legislature. In that capacity, I was co-chair of the Clean Air Caucus of Legislators. It's a bipartisan group of legislators that work on how we can improve air quality, in particular here in Utah. I also served as ranking member of most of the health and social services committees. So the issue of population health, the issue of public disparities, the issues of how marginalized communities are often the ones that are most disproportionately affected by concerns related to climate change, as well as clean air and everything that comes from it, a lot of what both Dr. Mendoza and Ms. Juarez have mentioned here, and that we're going to hear about today. Again, some of these concerns really do disproportionately affect communities of color and those from lower socioeconomic strata. One thing that I wanted to mention is there is a history, and a lot of people don't realize this, with Indigenous communities and with communities of color and with Latinx communities in particular, what we call our herencia y queredia, and which is taking care of the land and the history of being part of the land. This is nothing new for us. I mean, we think about the history of the Latino community in the United States and in the Western Hemisphere. We're talking centuries of care of the land, of respect for the land, of knowing that our Mother Earth gives to us. And so we need to be embraced as part of that conversation as nothing new. And so I am welcome for the opportunity to talk about these issues, but I do like to remind people that our communities, our peoples have been a part of this conversation, and we have often led the way for many, many centuries. And in recent times, we're having to kind of push ourselves into the space and ask you to listen to us and allow us those opportunities to speak up on issues of climate change, on issues of environmental justice, through our world, through our prism, and through our experience. So thank you for being here, and I look forward to the continued conversation.
Good afternoon. I guess it's afternoon now. We passed the 12 o'clock mark. My name is Sarah Gerneski. I'm a professor of sociology and also environmental studies here at the University of Utah. I spent 12 years before I came here in 2018 as a faculty member at the University of Texas El Paso on the U.S.-Mexico border. And I figured some of our conversation today would revolve around issues of air quality. And so I decided to present some research on behalf of my co-authors on Hurricane Harvey. Certainly with the climate crisis, we're going to see increasing storms and increasing extreme events. And while hurricanes don't affect Utah per se, they're certainly an important hazard in the United States and elsewhere. And I think lessons learned from events like this are applicable to other types of disasters that occur in other places. So I'm going to talk about Hurricane Harvey and impacts on vulnerable populations. So just to begin, since we don't always think a lot about hurricanes here in Utah, right, there has been an increase in hurricanes in the North Atlantic since the 1970s. Under climate change scenarios, they're expecting higher wind speeds, more precipitation, and with sea level rise and warming waters and growing populations, this issue is increasingly important. So I'm going to focus on Hurricane Harvey as an exemplar of broader trends in social vulnerability and extreme events. It's worth noting, and I'll talk about Harvey in a minute in case you don't remember that specific storm, but it's worth noting that the idea that a storm like this would occur once in every 100 years was standard knowledge as late as the 1990s. But now they're assuming storms like this are going to happen once every 16 years. So you see that as illustrative of this change. So Harvey. Hurricane Harvey was the end of August 2017. It was a Category 4 storm. It had over 200 kilometers per hour winds. They had a huge amount of rainfall. If you recall, the storm kind of parked over Houston and rained and rained and rained for days. So it was a serious event in Houston. And I guess now with Imelda recently, that's the next storm to hit Houston that had sort of major effects. But Houston is the fifth largest metropolitan area in the United States and has a population of nearly 7 million people. And there it is in Texas, in case you don't remember where that is. All right, so what my team and I did is with some funding from the National Science Foundation, we conducted a cell phone survey within 4 months of Hurricane Harvey to try to figure out people's experiences, the impacts, the near-term recovery. And our focus is on environmental injustice, social vulnerability, and social inequality. And so that is the focus of the project. We made contact with over 400 people. And I'm going to present to you today very briefly the results of multiple different projects that we have ongoing within this larger project. And then I'll stop talking. So our survey sample is representative of the Houston metropolitan area. 36% of greater Houston residents are white, 18% are black, and roughly 40% are Hispanic Latino. It's also worth noting that because we did a random sample of this area, we have people that have no damage included in our project, which gives us, we have one respondent who had their home completely destroyed and a little under half who didn't have any damage to their home. So we have a broad swath of Houston residents. So one of the first things we did is we looked for disproportionate impacts based on race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. Using our survey as well as census data, we found a pattern with the individual survey data whereby Black, Hispanic, and other racial ethnic minority households experienced greater flood extent at their home, and also families with lower socioeconomic status experienced greater flooding. We did a similar study at the census tract level and found similar patterns. And the map is our data for the flood extent. We worked with a contact at FEMA who created this layer of flooding based on Harvey. We're also interested in if Harvey affected people with disabilities. And this is a small but growing area of interest in the environmental justice research. And so looking specifically at that flood extent of Harvey, we found, and this we did at the neighborhood level because our survey didn't have enough people with disabilities to be able to analyze it. But we did find that neighborhoods that have higher proportions of disabled residents had greater Harvey-induced flooding in their neighborhoods. And so this is really just a start as we think about this important topic, but certainly disabled communities are ones we need to keep our eye on as we increasingly have more big storms like Harvey. We're also interested in how the petrochemical industry and all the accidents and accidental releases that happened with the petrochemical industry in Houston affected neighborhood residents and affected them unequally. So we got data from the Texas Environmental Commission. We found that there were 54 facilities that had accidental releases in the month following Harvey. And we created some an index and then related this to neighborhood demographics. And we looked at Corpus Christi, Greater Houston, and Beaumont. And what we see across the analyses is that minority communities were disproportionately represented in neighborhoods that were affected by these accidental releases of chemicals. Another thing that jumped out in all three of our study areas was the percentage of residents without access to a vehicle. And certainly if we think about evacuation and evacuating because of a petrochemical accident, having a vehicle is going to be really important to getting out of your neighborhood quickly. Now in Harvey, people were limited by flooding and all sorts of other things. But this is a specific measure of poverty that's relevant as we think about extreme events and environmental justice and climate change. We're also interested in the health effects of Hurricane Harvey. And even though just under half of our residents reported no home damage, over half of them experienced at least one physical health problem after Harvey. So the most common thing that people experienced were allergies, headaches, nose irritation, throat irritation, things that come from, for example, your home having mold in it and causing you to experience some of these irritations. We also saw mental health effects with about a fifth of the sample having post-traumatic stress scores on our scale that were above 40, meaning they're likely to have post-traumatic stress. And then we did an analysis to see if these health effects were distributed disproportionately. We found more health problems among people who did not evacuate. We saw with our post-traumatic stress variable that African Americans, older people, and those who lost their job due to Harvey having a significantly greater levels of post-traumatic stress. And also healthcare access, people were unable to access the healthcare they needed, and that was associated with post-Harvey unemployment, probably because in this country our health insurance is often connected to our employment, and also persons with disabilities. Then we're currently working on a paper about unmet needs. So these are things like going without drinking water, not having access to transportation, not having food, clothing, no bathroom access, no hot water, things like that. We asked about 11 different unmet needs. And we found that people experience a lot of unmet needs after Hurricane Harvey, which reflects just the extent and scope of the storm. And then in an analysis looking at racial ethnic disparities in these unmet needs, we found that non-Hispanic Blacks, and then we also, because the Hispanic population in Houston is so large and diverse, we were able to break out U.S.-born Hispanics and also look at citizenship within the foreign-born Hispanic population. And all these groups had significantly more unmet needs than non-Hispanic whites. And one of the interesting things, not surprising, is that the non-citizen Hispanic residents in our sample had significantly more unmet needs than the U.S.-born Hispanic residents, which is not surprising given the way in which citizenship conditions our access to many, many resources. And then we're also considering issues of assistance and recovery and the receipt of aid. And our analysis in this area actually found that minority residents in our sample were actually more likely than white residents to receive assistance from non-government organizations as well as any source. Families with children were also more likely to receive assistance, which is great, But we did, when we looked at then the relationship between receiving assistance and recovery, it wasn't significantly related. So while these communities, these residents were receiving more assistance, it wasn't translating into more complete near-term recovery. So we definitely need to think about the type of assistance that's provided and how that can most effectively serve socially vulnerable residents. And lastly, we also found 71. So 71 of these survey respondents, we had actually surveyed back in 2012 when we did a study about flood and air pollution risks in Houston. And we wanted to find everyone, like find all 600 people again, but that didn't work out. So we ended up with 484 that still live there and agreed to participate in a follow-up, but we could only reach 71. So we're somewhat limited in this analysis, but the one paper we did do with these 71 individuals showed us that families that had taken more home structural mitigation activities in 2012, so people that had raised their electrical components, that had storm shutters for their windows, those kinds of things, actually had all these benefits that were unexpected based on the literature. So we found that taking more actions back in 2012 to prepare for hurricanes and flooding resulted in significantly fewer physical health problems, fewer post-traumatic stress symptoms, less adverse event experiences in the 4 months following Harvey. So it seems like one thing that can be done and certainly requires assistance and aid for low-income communities is better protecting our home structures can hopefully have impacts that will be lessened. So to conclude, it's definitely the case that these results from Harvey and this huge published literature on social vulnerability and disasters tells us that the effects of these future severe storms that are likely to happen under climate change will not be evenly distributed. And I think these findings, along with all the other ones, right, are a call to action. We need mitigation assistance. We need to provide aid to people who need it, and certainly provide extra aid to people who really need it, like non-citizens in the United States. And this is going to require cooperation and involvement from a variety of actors. Thank you.
That's Sarah Gerneski, Professor of Sociology and Environmental and Sustainability Studies at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we are airing a panel discussion on how climate change will affect minority communities locally, nationally, and internationally. Here again is moderator Jenny Huen, Sustainability Ambassador from the U's Sustainability Office.
Thank you all for your lovely introductions. I have prepared some questions today for our panelists, so let's start out with the first one. How will climate change impact migration to the United States, particularly in light of anti-immigrant rhetoric, new restrictive policies, and the potential for climate change refugees? So we can start with Daniel and then make our way back down to Sarah.
That's a really interesting and complex question. Climate change, or a changing climate, is really one of the greatest threats, if not the greatest threat, to our existence right now. And I mean, the joke is that the U.S. might actually be climate refugees going up north to Canada. So we don't even need to just stop at people flooding the U.S. We may actually need to consider moving north. Personally, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the things that I do, because that kind of drives my passion for the things that then I like to bring academically. I think that in about 20 to 30 years, I'm going to be moving north to probably Idaho, probably northern Montana. I don't know if any of you have read or have seen that in about 20 years or so, Salt Lake is going to have a very similar climate to Las Vegas. And to compound that, home prices will probably be about the same as San Francisco. Both of those tragedies happening pretty much in about 20 years. I think that one of the factors we really need to talk about, and I'm glad that Professor Gerneski brought up sort of the inequalities in terms of aid, in terms of really accessibility for communities, is that not everyone, first of all, not everyone is as informed about the issue. Not everyone has the exact same amount of time or the resources or the knowledge to really take their best decisions for themselves, for their family, for their community. So I think that when we see the large discrepancies, I mean, this was a really interesting, the previous slide that showed that even though minority communities were able to retrieve more aid, that did not necessarily mean their lives were back together at the same level. And that's something that we definitely need to consider. Too many times, and I don't really want to take political sides on any issue, but when we look at certain events, for example, some of the migration that's going on, we don't actually start to think about why are these people fleeing? People are just thinking, oh, they're just coming here, want to make money, et cetera. But many of these communities are in civil war. Many of these communities are in multiple issues. They may have some sort of social strife. Some of them may actually be persecuted politically. They may have their families in danger. Well, now we throw in climate change. I had a colleague, actually, and his job was to be a consultant for Starbucks. So that's where he made his real money. And instead of academia, that was his day job. But his consultancy was where he looked at where Starbucks had to plant their new crops based on climate change. So he would say, well, what we have to do is, in the next 5 years, because of what we expect, the temperature change, the precipitation, et cetera, you need to move all your crops from here, further north, east, west, wherever they had to go. Well, think about what happens to that community. Think about all these people that are relying specifically on that. They have no other particular skill set. They may have actually destroyed their natural crops or their natural livelihood, their farms, whatnot, because Starbucks came in and said, and I'm not trying to vilify Starbucks, it's just an example of companies that do take climate change seriously and realize, well, we now have to move our crops, otherwise we're not going to have the yield that we have. So think about those communities of those members that all they know how to do is that. It's very similar to the fossil fuel industry. While we may be thinking, and I am definitely of the mindset of let's look at renewables, we also have to look at the communities that are left behind. What happens to people who just knew how to extract natural gas, coal, oil? Those people had no other training, potentially no other training, and potentially no other alternative. And that's where we're seeing all this crises in the Appalachian Mountains, et cetera, because all of a sudden you take out the livelihood and people have no idea what to do. So we really need to consider all of these socioeconomic factors when we're looking at potentially a change in climate and what's going to happen when these activities cease to exist and be available.
I guess I want to start by recognizing that migration, although we think that it's something that necessarily happens from country to country, is also a big issue that's happening within our own country and within everybody's country. The number one group of people who are migrating are rural people moving to urban community centers because climate change is impacting the ability for rural communities to continue their lifestyles and their traditions. This has a specifically harmful impact on what I would say, like the first example that comes to my mind are Native communities in the Southwest, like on Hopi or in the Dene Nation, who for time immemorial have been practicing traditional forms of agriculture, depending on balanced ecosystem services like rain and snowpack to be able to water crops and to be able to produce food that are totally disrupted by massive amounts of drought and also disrupted by the new economic system that has been planted here by the various ways that capitalism and agro-industry even have impacted our communities all around the country. Migration from rural areas to urban communities is impacting a lot of minoritized communities. And that has an impact first on, of course, the physical resources, but also culture, right? Like imagining how climate change is deeply impacting people's ability to be, especially if you are Indigenous, to be in the place that your ancestors are or have been is devastating culturally. This is also applicable to the communities in Guatemala who are, and all throughout Central America, who are severely impacted by the inability for food to be able to grow. Again, natural ecosystem services to water crops, which just isn't happening anymore. You can peer through like the New York Times and find a vast amount of articles that are specifically about people in Guatemala who are migrating north, usually towards the United States, in order to be able to feed their kids. Poverty and famine there is, it's getting to the level where the United Nations is addressing famine in Guatemala and through Central America. So we can see that the impacts of climate change, of especially United States consumerism of products that contribute greenhouse gas all around the nation in the U.S. and elsewhere, are contributing to these long-term and devastating impacts that people all around the nation are assessing. There are some really massive single causes of these greenhouse gases emissions that are affecting ecosystem services, and public lands in the U.S. are one of them. 25% of all of the greenhouse gas emissions coming from the United States are from public land extraction, from coal, natural gas, oil, tar sands, and other forms of mineral extraction that come on lands administrated by the Bureau of Land Management or the U.S. Forest Service. And that's a lot. Think about the goal that we keep hearing from the IPCC, you know, the 11 years, everything reduced, all greenhouse gas emissions reduced in the next 11 years by 50%. There's half of it right there. So, you know, when I think about public lands and about the vast impacts that people are forced to deal with, especially migrants, and ways that systemically that can be addressed, it's through your advocacy and your, whether it's a one-time volunteering or a sustained semester or even longer, helping to campaign and organize for the end of extraction on public lands. Think about it, in 5 years, a moratorium on fossil fuel extraction on public lands could be implemented, and we're halfway towards that goal of reducing climate emissions and allowing the ecosystem to restabilize and balance in order for communities to be able to stay home and also have self-determination in terms of being able to choose what kind of work they want to do, where they can live, and et cetera. So I would say that as much as, you know, we can think about these impacts that migrants, either from rural to urban or from one country to another, are facing because of climate change, and a lot of rhetoric about it being individual changes, as important and impactful and collectively measurable that is, there are also systemic things that have nothing to do with our individual consumer choices, like the energy dominance agenda we see from this federal administration, that can only be addressed through our willingness to act and to organize and to speak out against these kinds of things. So, you know, despite these sort of really big, heavy, kind of devastating things to think about in terms of migration and how minoritized communities are impacted, there are ways for us to take action against that right now.
So I think one of my biggest concerns, kind of where we are with in terms of a political climate, is the nativism that really does restrict us from thinking about symbiosis that exists between us as a global community. You know, we just had our president within the last couple of days talking at the UN about nations needing to think about protecting within their borders and solely within their borders, and not, and to fight against a globalized community. But unfortunately, when you look at the weather patterns, when you look at what's happening within our globe, just generally, we cannot think of ourselves as entities one and apart from each other. And I think that both Daniel and Olivia have brought that to light in terms of what they have shared. We exist in a global community, and that's something that we cannot parse words about. It's the reality. If you look at even when you're looking at national security, you've got the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States telling our administration that one of the biggest threats to even the U.S. security, but just global security in terms of violence, in terms of communities turning in upon each other, in terms of civil war, is tied specifically to climate change. Scarcity propagates that. Scarcity precipitates political instability in our world, between nations, within nations, between communities, based on their income status, and to try to say that we are going to be one in of ourselves as a nation really just is putting on blinders. So that is one thing I just really wanted to make sure that we understand, that in the context of global geopolitical issues, that United States cannot be by ourselves. We are part of a global community. And when there is pain and when there is suffering and when there is scarcity in one country, it will impact us. And we can't just close our eyes to that. Just kind of reinforcing some of what's already been said, a recent article in The Guardian noted that today there are 64 million forced migrants around the world, more than ever before. As was mentioned, they are fleeing war, persecution, disaster, and yet climate change. The UN estimates that by 2050, there will be 200 million people forcibly displaced from their homes due to climate change alone. We cannot inhibit that through rhetorical jingoism, rhetorical walls that we are putting up in front of each other and in front of people that are desperately just trying to survive.
Thank you. I guess I'll add here to what everyone has said in terms of the question about how will climate change impact migration. I guess I want to be hopeful that climate change will drive the United States to be more open and more welcoming to immigrants from around the world that need a place to go for a little while. However, I'm worried in our current political climate that is a pie in the sky dream, right? Our current president is not granting temporary protection to people from the Bahamas who want to come to the United States because their livelihoods were entirely destroyed by Dorian. And that's very, very concerning, right? In my previous community of El Paso, after the horrible shooting in the Walmart, it took several days for the community to know how many people had been shot and how many people had been killed, because some of the people who were harmed were immigrants, and they were afraid that ICE was going to deport them back to Mexico. And so they did not go to the hospital, they went home, right? And this type of climate is just, social climate is terrifying if we think about additional climate crises from around the world and the fact that we need to be welcoming to our neighbors, we need to, you know, accept people and try to provide assistance to people who are in need. So I think that this is very scary and this is very troubling. And I think one of the things that we can do, if we're old enough, if we're permitted to by our citizenship, and if we don't have a criminal record that holds us back, right, is to vote. And if I think back to my time at UTEP in El Paso, I had so many students who were desperate to vote but couldn't. And so I think that we need to make sure that we exercise our right to vote, because I do believe that federal policy is a key step in changing the course of human history. I think back about the particulate matter in the United States and the way in which our levels of particulate matter have dropped, right, over the past several decades in response to federal controls on how much we can emit. And so I'm hopeful that with proper, you know, federal action, signing on to climate accords, taking the steps that we need to, that it could possibly be okay. But I definitely think, in addition to our own, you know, consumerist choices, voting is really, really important if you're able to.
That's Sarah Gerneski, professor of sociology and environmental and sustainability studies at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here is moderator and sustainability ambassador, Jenny Huen.
All right. Thank you, panelists, for your deep and powerful responses. That leads us to our second question. As climate change increases competition for resources, including basic needs like water and food, what can we do to ensure equitable and affordable access for all, especially communities most affected by climate change?
I think this question really ties in to the first one. I think that accessibility to resources, and as Representative Chavez Hauk just mentioned, when there's scarcity, there's going to be desperation. If you need to take care of your family, if your basic needs are not met, you may take drastic action. Drastic action could potentially lead to risking your own lives, potentially risking the lives of others. And I mean, we've seen this on many facets. Desperation can take the form of fleeing your home country. It could take the form of exercising or just letting out your repressed anger at society. We've seen, for example, the LA riots that happened over 3 decades ago. These are just examples of what people can and will do when just pushed to the brink. Now, how can we think about having equitable resources? How can we think about having equal access when, first of all, the infrastructure is not there in place? How can we think about that when there's so many voices that are muted? I mean, the example about the El Paso Walmart, where immigrants were and people who were potentially undocumented were scared to go to the hospital to actually live, to be treated, because of fear of deportation. That basically just tells you right there that there's not equal medical access, equal medical care. We know so much about, for example, the insurance crisis. Every single time, it seems that almost every week or at least every month, there's a discussion about rolling back Medicare, rolling back Medicaid, and really affecting communities that are the most disadvantaged, that are the most vulnerable. So looking at the basic necessities, medical aid, shelter, food, water, forget climate change for a second. Just think about, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago when that wasn't such a large crisis. It wasn't such a looming, present crisis. We couldn't even handle social equality, equal access to resources. Now, with this ever-pressing problem, I mean, I was really shocked. I knew that the number was around 50 million for climate refugees. And seeing that it's going to almost multiply by a factor of 5 or 6 in the very near future, I think that this is really a crisis, and we need to really try to understand if we're at a baseline without all these emergencies, without basically a natural disaster happening almost every month, even more often than that, then we need to really assess how do we really start almost from the ground up and try to provide everyone with equal access.
Okay, do we have any Edward Abbey fans in the audience? Lovers of our public lands, Red Rock, and his righteous insurrectionaryism. So I came across a letter to the editor he sent to Esquire magazine way back in the day, going off about off-road vehicle use in Moab and the devastating impacts that it has on the community. And he ends his righteously insurrectionary letter with this. I look forward to the day when oil and gas rationing is implemented so it can put a stop to this nonsense. But I would actually argue, Mr. Abbey, that oil and gas rationing, should it actually come to happen, probably won't impact that nonsense and people who recreationally and outside of basic needs use resources to live their lives. For a long time, before climate change has escalated to like the catastrophic events that it creates in our world today, basic resource needs have not been provided to minoritized communities and afforded by communities in power. You can think about how people all throughout the Diné Nation, whether they're in the Utah or Arizona or New Mexico part of the nation, don't have running water and have to drive with their tankers to get water and have to ration water like really heavily in order to be able to have this basic resource. How just now there is an organization that is working to make sure that houses all around the Diné Nation have an address so that they have accessibility to being able to call an ambulance when somebody gets sick, right? Like there are so many places on the Diné Nation that don't even have an address right now. I think that the same thing that has caused climate change has caused this lack of access to resources in minoritized communities, and that's colonialism and that's capitalism. It's the ways that our system have promoted and worked toward this idea of infinite growth on the lands of peoples who have been stewarding these lands for a long time, who have been contributors and recipients of the resources in this place that we live and all throughout Earth, who are now taking advantage of, whose lands have been taken and who have been, I mean, and if we're going to continue talking about the cases of like indigenous nations, created treaties that put them in whatever situations that they are in right now. And I want to say that, you know, I want to say that pointing out that like not every indigenous nation has been given a sort of like bad deal or like had a treaty that didn't work for them, right? Like there are some cases where indigenous nations were very involved in the creation of their own treaty and choosing like where their reservation is and how their governance system works, and it's working for them. And there are indigenous nations where that's not the case. Yeah, climate change overall is impacting people's accessibility to resources, but there are the things that have caused climate change, which is impacting people's accessibility to resources for a long time. I also want to talk about how I have family members who no longer live in Mexico because the water, the river that was in their community that my uncles have grown up with isn't there anymore. And it's not necessarily because of climate change. It's because of people up north who use the resource. And so many rivers are like that today that don't flow into the Pacific, into the Gulf anymore because of the high, vast amounts of water consumption that is specifically coming from businesses privately owned in the United States. So that is, of course, a major factor in deciding like why economic or in determining how economic devastation happens in our neighboring communities and how communities end up being here. So, I think that in terms of the ways that these things can be addressed is in the case of the Diné Nation, supporting organizations like the Rural Utah Project, which are like, for example, helping addresses be created for homes, or supporting the conservation movement. And like if you're a person who's into agriculture and the huge impact that it has on our changing climate, then thinking about in what ways your internships, your career path can put you in a place of advocating for water conservation in the Farm Bill or for other forms of private or nonprofit water conservation, which is possible to be implemented. Think about it. Places like Israel, way drier than here, have a water surplus because they have been implementing very strict water conservation policies since the 70s. And they're exporting their food, right? Like you're hard pressed to find hummus here without the chickpeas having come from Israel. So the world in which the waters do flow across the borders that don't exist and that communities have the autonomy to make decisions about resource use definitely exists. And that world, I think, in our imagination is very possible through the internships and the future jobs and classes that you can continue to take and learn about to help implement these things and create this change.
Sorry to interrupt. That was all beautiful responses. Before the forum ends today, I would just like to turn the remaining time over to our lovely audience to ask a couple of questions. So with that being said, do any of you guys have questions for our panelists? Yep.
I just wonder, like, what is your guys' sentiment on when you hear, like, other nations, especially, like, Europe and, like, Israel, where they're making leaps and bounds over our nation, who is supposed to be the best and the most wonderful, and yet we can't get things like this right?
So I think it goes back to Susan's comments related to voting and participation. And I know that people get frustrated in our country when they feel that they feel that their vote doesn't count. They'll vote for things like there were some amazing propositions that were in Utah's ballot last year, and now the legislature is undoing most of them. But I always try to encourage people that, you know, that if you don't vote, then you are in a way voting. If you, your absence of a vote tells those in power what's important to you. And if your voice isn't there through your vote, then you are saying something. So I think that when we look at some of these other countries, these other democracies and these other communities, these other state nation states, that you have a larger participation level of citizens who are in the vote, who are voting, so that there's an accountability, an electoral accountability to individuals that are making decisions on our behalf. You know, we could talk about corporate funding of election. I mean, there's so much that is tied to the fact of who has a voice in this country and who doesn't. But the balance to that is that everybody needs to get out and vote. We also need to recognize our own sense of privilege. Some of us have more privilege than others, and utilizing that privilege to provide voice to others and let them step into that space. But I think that voting is again, I would concur, is one of the most important things that we can do, because it's when people aren't heard, that's when the powers that be make those decisions on their own, and they're distinctive from what we see from other countries. But I'll let others weigh in on that.
So over the last couple months, we've seen a couple of landmark reports on mental health in Utah, specifically the kind of disparities we're seeing among university students. So I just want, if you could talk on how the climate crisis is affecting mental health and how it will continue to affect health, especially among the youth. That'd be great. Thanks.
Sure. Yes, I've also seen some of those reports about mental health in the United States, specifically mental health of college students. And I see it in my own classes, right, where I have multiple students in any given semester who have serious mental health problems, requiring them to be hospitalized, to miss school, etc. And so it's definitely a big concern. And I think if you... It's hard not to feel depressed, I think, when we think about, you know, what's happening in the world, what's happening with the climate crisis, what's happening economically, what's happening in terms of migration and immigrants. And I worry that the solution to this mental health crisis is this broader sort of change in political and economic orientation. I mean, I worry. I have a 13-month-old daughter, right? And I look at her and I'm thinking, like, what is it going to be like for you when you're in college? What is our earth going to be like? How hot is it? What are the storms going to be like? What about the air pollution? And so I don't know the literature on the mental health crisis as related to climate change, but I definitely see the logic of associations between just all of the uncertainty that college students experience today about their own economic future, which is related to climate change, and how those things are linked.
I was just going to add, I think that part of the challenge we have to currently is isolationism. You know, I was talking about it in terms of nation states, but I think sometimes we in community aren't watching out for each other. And I think it's always important, especially when we think of such social determinants of health and what people might be suffering from, what families might be struggling with, that we as neighbors, we as individuals that are part of a broader community, need to be able to help people find those resources, especially if we're in a place of privilege and we have an opportunity to help those people access the support that they need.
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.